If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
I North Highlands, Sacramento.
Okay, Palestinians have to be disarmed. What about the other side?
Hamas leadership says it is now willing to negotiate a more lasting ceasefire in Gaza.
We will have the details from an NPR interview.
For Monday, December 8th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. President Trump says the government will spend $12 billion helping farmers navigate economic challenges,
including challenges caused by the White House's own tariff policy.
It's imperative that the Trump administration get these payments out as soon as possible.
And just how many different species are there on Earth?
The known number is about 2.5 million, but new research suggests that may be way too low.
The range of estimates of how many species are out there are from the low millions to the low trillions.
Those stories and more after this summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. At the Supreme Court, justices seem open to overruling a 90-year precedent that's prevented presidents from removing members of independent agencies at will. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports the case could reshape the balance of power within the federal government.
The case before the court today sprung from President Trump's firing of a Democratic member of the Federal Trade Commission. But the case could have far-reaching implications. The Trump administration argued the Constitution gives the president the right to remove anyone who assists him in carrying out his executive duties for any reason. The administration said the president must have such removal powers in order to remain accountable to the people who elected him. On the other side, lawyers for the fired FTC commissioner said there's a long historical tradition of creating independent agencies insulated from presidential control, and that limits on presidential power are necessary to protect the public's interests. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
President Trump's offering $12 billion in financial relief to farmers who've been harmed by his tariffs.
What we're doing is we're taking a relatively small portion of that, and we're going to be giving and providing it to the farmers in economic assistance. And we love our farmers. And as you know, the farmers like me.
The White House announcement is part of President Trump's response to the negative fallout of trade policies that he said would favor U.S. manufacturers and workers. In its trade war with the U.S., China stopped buying American farm products earlier this year. But in subsequent talks between Washington and Beijing, Trump says President Xi has since committed to over $40 billion in soybean purchases. Netflix and Paramount are in a bidding war for Warner Brothers Discovery. Today, Paramount, a Skydance corporation headed up by the Ellison family, put in an all-cash tender offer for $30 a share. NPR's David Folkenflik reports on the factors that have led Paramount to offer shareholders $18 billion more in cash than Netflix.
Paramount's looking at the landscape and saying we're too small. We can't compete. Netflix is the world's largest streamer. It's the nation's largest streamer. There's also Amazon, which, yeah, it bought MGM, which is a small little studio, but it's, you know, Amazon has all the money in the world, the everything store. It's looking at Apple, and it's looking at Disney, which several years ago bulked up by acquiring most of the Murdoch's Fox Entertainment properties out there in Hollywood. Paramount says, look, if we combine together, we're two of the old-time studios, Paramount and Warner Brothers. We can do this. We have all these cable properties. You have cable properties. Let's be in business together. Let's take on these giants.
That's NPR's David Folkenflik reporting. At the close, the Dow is down 215 points. You're listening to NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. Attorney General Rob Bonta says his office stands ready to assist San Jose officials as they investigate an anti-Semitic incident at a local high school last week. That's after students at Banham High School formed a swastika with their bodies on the school's football field and posted a photo to social media. Bonta says his office will step in to help if asked by local police and school officials.
There's no room for hate in California, no matter who you are, where you're from, who you love, how you pray. You belong here, and you deserve to be safe and be able to thrive free of hate.
The Attorney General noted that in addition to prosecuting hate crimes, his office compiles a report every year examining the data around hate crimes and hate incidents. That information, Bonta says, helps shape policies aimed at countering hate. More than 22,000 San Francisco residents lost power this morning. That's after an equipment failure at PG&E's Hunter Point station that occurred shortly before 10 a.m. The outage affected neighborhoods including the city's Outer Mission and Bayview, Bernal Heights, and Hunter's Point. According to a PG&E spokesperson, power to those neighborhoods was safely restored shortly before noon. More news online at kqed.org. I'm Natalia Navarro.
Support comes from San Francisco Bay University with degrees in tech and business for an AI-driven economy. sfbu.edu. Support for NPR comes from Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. And the listeners of KQED. And support for KQED also comes to us from Smuin's The Christmas Ballet. This joyful production features both classical ballet and contemporary numbers, with new editions premiering alongside audience favorites. Now through December 28th, tickets at smuinballet.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. A narrow window might be opening for a sustainable ceasefire in Gaza. Hamas leaders tell NPR the group is willing to lay down its arms, but with conditions. It is a major shift for the armed Palestinian group after 2 years of war, and it comes at a delicate moment in the ceasefire that President Trump had brokered. NPR international correspondent Aya Batrawi joins us from Qatar, where she met with two senior Hamas leaders to discuss what they are willing to concede. Hey there.
Hi.
So Israel's prime minister says the next phase of the ceasefire is about the disarmament of Hamas. What did the group's senior leaders tell you about that?
Well, Scott, I think it's important for us to say that Hamas is a group that sees itself as a political, ideologically Islamist resistance movement, and its leadership maintains that Palestinians under international law have a right to bear arms so long as there's an Israeli occupation and no Palestinian state. And while they continue to insist this is their right, we're now hearing a shift, and that is due to pressure from Israel's continued occupation of Gaza and from regional countries the group depends on. Now, Bassem Naim, a member of Hamas's political leadership based in Qatar, told NPR the group is willing not to use its weapons for 5, 7, or even 10 years.
During this time, we are ready to store it, to lay it down with Palestinian guarantees, with regional guarantees, international guarantees, not to use it as long as we are not attacked. Because the second question is always, okay, Palestinians have to be disarmed. What about the other side?
And on that other side, he also says there has to be a political track, negotiations that end with an independent Palestinian state. But the creation of a Palestinian state is something this Israeli government insists will not happen. And crucially, Scott, talks on all of this haven't even begun. Mediators say they're waiting on the Trump administration to kickstart phase two negotiations still.
So how would this all happen? And what does the ceasefire plan that both sides agreed to back in October, what does that say about how to do this?
It really doesn't say much. It's a vague plan that both sides agree to, but it does state that Hamas will decommission its weapons, but it doesn't say how or in what order. And the Trump plan also calls for something else, an International Stabilization Force, or ISF, to be deployed to Gaza. Now, the Trump administration wants the ISF on the ground in Gaza by early next year. The U.S. even secured a U.N. mandate for that already. Now, we've heard Turkey, Egypt, Indonesia, and Pakistan as possible countries that could join, but none have yet committed because they want to know exactly what their troops would be doing in Gaza. Would they be in charge of storing Hamas's weapons, destroying tunnels? You know, these countries are not going to send their soldiers there to fight Hamas. They want this to be a peacekeeping force that's welcomed on the ground. And Hamas says it supports the deployment of the ISF under certain conditions. Here's Naim again.
We are welcoming the ISF as a peacekeeping force near the borders to separate between the parties, but all Palestinians are against any mandate which authorized these forces to intervene inside the cities in any direct duties against the Palestinian will.
So he's saying they agree on the ISF acting as a buffer between Israel and Hamas to monitor the ceasefire, but not in population centers.
Last question, big picture. You have this interview with Hamas leaders after 2 years of war. This is a war that began with the group's deadly attack on Israel on October 7th. And 2 years later, Gaza is in ruins. Tens of thousands of people have been killed in Israeli airstrikes. How are they viewing this military campaign?
Yes, Gaza has become unlivable. People are wounded, living in tents. Winter is coming. Families are still hungry. Hospitals are decimated. And the group has lost a lot of popularity in Gaza because of this. But they say the world witnessed these Israeli attacks in Gaza and that it turned public opinion against Israel globally and in the U.S. And they call this a strategic, irreversible win despite the very high cost.
That is NPR's Aya Batrawi in Doha, Qatar. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Scott.
Today, President Trump announced a $12 billion plan to help farmers across the country. Speaking from the White House, he praised the plan as an example of how his administration is making agriculture a priority compared to the way it was during the Biden administration.
They hated the farmer. I love the farmer.
Well, but at the same time that farmers are struggling with the financial consequences of Trump's tariffs, they're also facing more expensive health care. Drew Hawkins with Gulf States Newsroom spoke to some farmers in Louisiana about their concerns over these rising costs, and he joins us now. Hi, Drew.
Hi, Elsa.
Hi. Okay, so tell us what you're hearing from some of these farmers.
Sure thing. So just today I spoke with a farmer named James Davis. He's a third-generation row crop farmer in northeast Louisiana, and actually that region was represented at President Trump's roundtable today with a rice farmer sitting right next to him. Mm-hmm. Davis grows cotton, corn, and soybeans, and he says farmers have been hit really hard this year. He says the Trump administration's tariffs mean they can't export their commodities because other countries have also placed retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods. So they can't sell them and make back enough money. And that also means it makes it harder to get crop loans the following year.
Well, how did Davis respond to the announcement today?
Well, Davis said that the Trump administration's tariff relief plan is really crucial.
It is hard to make crop loans work on paper. So it's imperative and very imperative that the Trump administration get these payments out as soon as possible.
And Davis says that without what the president did today, which he described as a bailout, many farmers are going to go belly up, is how he put it. They won't be able to continue farming. And that includes himself, he's been doing this for generations.
Well, these people that you spoke to across Louisiana, these farmers, I understand that they all expressed concern over rising health care costs, specifically the enhanced premium tax credits, right? Like, that's the extra help to buy Obamacare health insurance that's expiring at the end of this month. What did you hear about that particular piece of all this?
Right. So for Davis, who describes himself as a moderate Democrat, he says that those are also crucial because many farmers have been struggling to make ends meet this year. It also means that paying for health insurance is harder, right? And I also spoke to Daniel Rhodes. He runs a small landscaping business near West Monroe, Louisiana, which is in House Speaker Mike Johnson's district. Now, Rhodes is a Republican, and he says he supports Speaker Johnson's leadership, except when it comes to health care and the ACA subsidies.
This was a big one that I really just took the opposite side of the fence and said, like, look, this is a crazy hill to die on to say we're going to lock up the budget over healthcare subsidies. Like, man, pick any other thing.
And you heard Rhodes mention, you know, pick any other thing, right? He said he'd rather see cuts to military spending or other large scale government spending, not healthcare.
Well, then what would the people you spoke to say they would like Congress to do when it comes to health insurance costs?
So in general, the people I talked to, what they want is they want Congress to stop playing politics, is how they put it. Speaker Johnson's district is very rural, lots of poverty, and a lot of people will be impacted if these subsidies go away without some sort of plan. And I think maybe the best way I can sum it up is a conversation I had with Susie Halley this past weekend. She's a Republican, she supports President Trump, and she runs a food bank in a place called Farmerville in Union Parish, which is in House Speaker Mike Johnson's district. And I asked her if she had a message for Speaker Johnson, and what she said was to fix it. She says people are already struggling to pay health insurance premiums already, right now. So if the subsidies go away, it'll only make it even harder for them.
That is Drew Hawkins from Gulf States Newsroom in New Orleans. Thank you so much, Drew.
Thank you, Elsa.
In 2010, a famed ecologist, Robert May, asked a hypothetical question to the scientific community. If an alien spaceship landed on Earth, one of the first questions they would likely ask would be, how many distinct life forms, how many species live on your planet? He said we wouldn't have a good answer, and how awkward would that be, right? NPR's Nate Rott reports on how that is changing.
Think back real quick to your middle school biology class, to taxonomy. You know, domain, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. You remember that, right? That categorical system, what we all use to describe life on Earth, was invented in the 1700s by Swedish biologist Carl Linnaeus. And since then, scientists have described millions of species.
Currently 2.5 million. And that's, again, that's described species. That's known species.
John Weens is a professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Arizona. And he's the co-author of a new paper published in the journal Science Advances that looks at the history of species discovery, where it started, how it's evolved, and where it's going.
Well, we went back to Linnaeus. Yeah, we went back to the 1750s.
And they found there was a slow ramping up of discovery over time.
And then it hits this peak around 1900. And then there's a dramatic drop in the early 1900s. And you can probably guess what that is.
Any guesses?
It's World War I. And it climbs back up again. And then, boom, World War II. And it falls back down again. And then it's been climbing ever since. And we're now uncharted territory, you know, the fastest rates of species description per year that we've ever seen.
An average of 17,000 newly discovered species every year. In large part, he says, because we're just better at looking.
I feel like we spend so much time talking about whether or not there's life on other planets, but your paper shows that, like, we don't even really know how much life exists here.
Oh, yeah, no, the range of estimates of how many species are out there are from the low millions to the low trillions.
That's wild.
Yeah, and a lot of that uncertainty is associated with microbes.
Microscopic life that's understandably harder to find than some new species of cat. Weens' best guess of how many species there are on the planet is between the low hundreds of millions to low billions. So he's got a wide landing pad.
But yeah, just like tons of species out there, we'd say it's a poorly known planet that we live on.
Poorly known, but improving. And Wien says the more we can learn about what's living on Earth, the better, because we can better protect what exists, and less altruistically, we can potentially benefit from what we find. Take Ozempic, the very much in vogue weight loss drug.
The basis for it was inspired by Gila monster venom.
So who knows, he says, what else we might find. Nate Rott, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from the Golden Gate National Parks Conservancy, protecting beloved Bay Area parks like Crissy Field, Marin Headlands, Land's End, and more. Learn how to keep these parks welcoming for all at parksconservancy.org. El Camino Health. Open enrollment happens once a year. More about which health plans provide access to El Camino Health doctors and nationally recognized hospitals at elcaminohealth.org/open enrollment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Davis, head of live events at KQED. It's our winter season, so it's time to get cozy and connect with others over some delicious food. Each of these events is going to feature a comfort food staple and give you a chance to learn more about the culture behind it and to taste some great samples. There's nothing that builds stronger community bonds than breaking bread together. Check them out at kqed.org/events.
Monday marks 1 year since Syria's former dictator Bashar al-Assad fled the country. We check in with Syrians we first spoke to back then to see how their lives have changed since. Hear that story and more next time on The World.
The story from Syria and other news around the globe at 2 o'clock.
With healthcare subsidies set to expire, best guesses are the uninsured rate in Tennessee is going to jump by 40%.
So these are folks that don't necessarily have a ton of money, and so they're going to be a lot more price sensitive.
I'm Kai Rizdal, Elasticity of Demand in Real Life. Next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace with the financial news of the day, first at 4:30. Get an update with Kai Rizdal again at 6:30 p.m. on KQED News. Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis, with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay in theaters this Friday. You're a part-time controller specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. And by the supporters of KQED.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. The United States is buying less stuff from China this year in the face of President Trump's tariffs, but China is still finding plenty of customers elsewhere around the world. The country's trade surplus actually hit a record high this year, topping $1 trillion for the first time. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
President Trump's double and for a time even triple digit tariffs on goods from China have definitely put a damper on trade between the two countries, but China remains a global manufacturing powerhouse. Customs data released by China today show November exports to the U.S. plunged almost 29% from a year ago. But Mary Lovely, who's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, says China has more than made up for that drop with increased exports to the rest of the world.
From the point of view of foreign buyers, this stuff is good. You've got, you know, good or better quality and prices are good.
China has found willing customers in Europe, Africa, Latin America, and the rest of Asia for all kinds of exports, from furniture and apparel to electric cars. The country's also exporting lots of components and raw materials that'll be fashioned into finished products elsewhere. In some cases, Lovely says those Chinese parts will still end up in the United States.
China's been successful in working around the tariffs to serve the U.S. market, but also breaking into these new markets.
China's imports, on the other hand, are not growing nearly so fast, highlighting the continued weakness of the country's domestic market. With a month to go in the calendar year, China's trade surplus has surpassed $1 trillion. In contrast, the United States has a big and growing trade deficit. Even though the U.S. is buying less from China this year, it's buying more from other countries. Despite the president's worldwide tariffs, total imports jumped more than 9% in the first 8 months of the year. Some of that increase may be temporary. Lovely says importers have taken advantage of brief lulls in the trade war this year to stockpile in hopes of avoiding even higher tariffs in the future.
We saw a burst of imports coming in when we might have expected, you know, the uncertainty of the trade policy to cause a chilling effect. But we do expect those levels to drop.
While the president has recently relaxed tariffs on some items in response to complaints about the high cost of living, the U.S. is still taxing most imports at the highest level in 90 years. Those tariffs have not halted global trade, but they are reshaping it. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Today, Syria celebrates the first anniversary of the fall of its repressive former regime. In just 11 days last year, cities held by the Assad regime and its Russian and Iranian allies fell until opposition forces reached Damascus and took power. Correspondent Jane Araf sends this report from the country's capital.
Dawn prayers this morning coincided with the moment President Bashar al-Assad fled Damascus a year ago under Russian protection. This was a mosque in the Midan district of the capital as worshippers filed out. The men chanting, the women expressing their happiness, the sheer joy and relief of victory after decades of repression.
That was fireworks, a lot of fireworks in the past couple of days. This neighborhood was one of the centers of the uprising in 2012, and all along the walls of the mosque for more than an entire block are the photos of hundreds of people, mostly young men, who were killed in the government crackdown.
Every day since the criminal regime is gone, we have joy and freedom, says a neighborhood resident, Latifa Mohideen. Every day. And then she beckons me back to thank the United States for lifting sanctions. Trump stood with us, she says. We thank him and the administration and all the people who love us. President Ahmad Ashara, a one-time al-Qaeda fighter, told the nation he would work hard to fulfill Syria's promise.
The people granted us their trust after years of oppression and injustice, and entrusted us with responsibility. So let our motto be honesty, and our pledge be construction.
In Damascus, most people have been celebrating for days ahead of what is now a new national holiday. Syrian-American activist Moaz Mustafa worked for years towards what often seemed an impossible dream of toppling Assad.
The pure joy that everyone sees here is just an expression of how much evil they lived under. And so it's just really, really, really rare that good defeats evil.
Bashar al-Assad, threatened by revolt against his regime's widespread repression, killing, and corruption, called in the help of Iran and Russia to put down uprisings. The fighting lasted 13 years. The UN says about 500,000 people were killed, and hundreds of thousands are missing. At a mass grave discovered just a few months ago, not far from Damascus, activists estimate there might be 20,000 bodies. A former soldier who was forced to drive a truck filled to the brim with bodies of people executed or tortured to death shows us the site. He chain smokes as his wife, known as Ali, talks about a mass grave she saw herself. All the bodies were stuffed together, she says. The testimony will likely be used in war crime trials, and neither she nor her husband, Abu Ali, want their full names used. Although Syrians now have relatively immense freedom, some are more afraid than they were before. President Shah's new security forces include former militants who have been implicated in revenge killings on Druze and Alawite minorities. A June suicide bombing claimed by a militant Sunni Muslim group at a church has also left many Christians in fear. In many places, though, there's a new sense of possibilities.
I'm walking into this car showroom, marble floors, and cars so shiny, they're almost blinding. A lot of them in bright colors. There's turquoise and bright green and seafoam colored, and they are all electric.
We are all company in Syria.
Afrah Sharif is the CEO of 77 Auto, which imports the cars from China. The old regime had approved their factory to assemble them in Syria. And 2 years later, it inexplicably shut the factory down. It's not just people who are well off who are happier. In one of Damascus's many second-hand markets, Bilal Falaha says he earns about $5 a day. His family home was destroyed, and at 40, he's never been married. You can't propose to someone without a house to live in. Things will get better, he says, but people have to work hand-in-hand with the state. The vendors point out that they come from almost every ethnic and religious group, and they all get along. On this muddy, noisy street, despite all he's lost, Falaha sees a better Syria. Love is what builds a country, he says. For NPR News, I'm Jane Arraf in Damascus.
NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from the San Francisco Symphony, presenting holiday family films on the big screen as the San Francisco Symphony performs the scores live. Learn more about their holiday programs at sfsymphony.org/holiday. The Watermark at San Jose, offering assisted living and memory care with amenities like a fitness and wellness center, massage therapy room, a salon, and on-site restaurants. Located in Silicon Valley, learn more at sanjosewatermark.com. The holiday season is right around the corner, and we want to know how you're going to be celebrating. Are you doing anything different this year? Maybe making a new dish? Visiting a new place? Share your stories with KQED's Perspectives. Go to kqed.org/perspectives to submit your piece today. On Monday afternoon, I'm Dave Freeman on KQED at 1:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Scott, there is a lot of history behind hair.
I mean, Elsa, I'll have to take your word for it.
For four decades, a museum told the story of hair care.
These things got shoved in attics and forgotten about. But when you appreciate it and you see it in a collection such as this, they're still remembered.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. 12 FBI agents who say they recently got fired for kneeling at a racial justice protest 5 years ago are suing the Bureau. NPR's Carrie Johnson has more.
The new lawsuit filed in federal court in Washington says the FBI agents did not have training in crowd control. They lacked helmets, riot shields, and other equipment when they were confronted by some hostile crowd members at a racial justice protest in June 2020. To defuse the situation, FBI agents closest to the crowd took a knee. They were investigated over the matter years ago, but nothing happened. Then, after new leaders joined the Bureau this year, they were investigated again and fired for unprofessional conduct, shortcutting the formal discipline process. Now those 12 former agents are asking for back pay and to return to their jobs. The FBI declined comment, citing pending litigation. Carrie Johnson, NPR News.
A man accused of stabbing a passenger on a commuter train in Charlotte, North Carolina, is being held without bond. From member station WFAE, Julian Berger says this marks the second stabbing attack on light rail there in just a few months.
Authorities say 33-year-old Oscar Solezano Garcia had been drinking when he stabbed a man on a light rail train Friday. He faces five charges, including attempted first-degree murder. The Department of Homeland Security says Solezano Garcia is an undocumented immigrant from Honduras who had been deported twice before. President Trump weighed in over the weekend, saying Charlotte Democrats are, quote, destroying the city. In August, the stabbing death of Irina Zarutska on the Charlotte Light Rail drew national scrutiny. Allies of President Trump pointed to the case as evidence that federal intervention was needed. Last month, the Trump administration conducted an immigration crackdown in Charlotte and around the state capital of Raleigh. For NPR News, I'm Julian Berger in Charlotte.
This is NPR. Tens of thousands of women took to the streets across Brazil to protest gender-based violence and a record number of women being murdered. From Rio, Julia Carneiro reports.
On Rio's Copacabana beach, women put out dozens of black crosses and marched with banners. Crowds laid down on São Paulo's Paulista Avenue to symbolize mourning and chanted, "Stop killing us." The movement, dubbed Women Alive, was triggered by a series of high-profile attacks. In São Paulo, a 31-year-old woman was run over by a former boyfriend and dragged by his car for over half a mile. The incident was captured by video and went viral. Last year, almost 1,500 women were murdered in Brazil in domestic disputes or in incidents triggered by misogyny. It's the highest number since a law was created to recognize femicides 10 years ago. For NPR News, I'm Julia Carneiro in Rio de Janeiro.
President Trump announced a long-promised aid package today to American farmers that have been hurt by his aggressive trade policies and changing tariff rates. Farmers here have been struggling to sell their crops as China stops buying American goods as part of Trump's broader trade war. Soybean farmers have been hit especially hard. The $11 billion aid package will help many crop farmers who back Trump politically during his presidential campaign. You're listening to NPR News.
Support on Monday afternoon for KQED comes from San Francisco Baykeeper, combining boat and drone investigations with science-based advocacy and litigation, Baykeeper works to hold polluters accountable to protect the health of the Bay and Bay Area communities. Learn more at baykeeper.org. And Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. Have you tried our crossword puzzles? Clues this week include big name and pineapples, and type of chance with little chance. Find the latest puzzle at kqed.org/crossword. Support for NPR comes from MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more. MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And by the supporters of KQED.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. The college football playoff is set, and everyone is happy about it. No drama or controversy at all. Just kidding, that is absolutely not the case. This, as a reminder, is only the second year of the current 12-team playoff format. But yet again, it has come under fire over which schools got in and which were left out. NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan joins me now. Becky, I thought expanding to 12 was going to solve all these problems. What is happening?
Good one. You know, it's actually crazy to think about this now, but last year there was so much more consensus at this time.
Right.
I thought last year it was like there was controversy, but it pales in comparison.
What specifically was worse this year? Because everyone's mad.
Yeah. I mean, last year it really just came down to the final spot. There was like this debate over which of two teams should get that last spot. But I think this year it's just been a mess. I mean, there is one undefeated team at the top. That's Indiana. Then there are six major conference teams who all have one loss. That's not controversial. But after that, there was this whole just like muddy mess of pretty good teams with two or three losses. It was very challenging, it turned out, to rank them, and no surprise people are unhappy with the results.
Let's get to the most unhappy people. What teams were left out?
Yes, I think the biggest snub, or certainly the most vocally unhappy, is Notre Dame. They lost their first two games of this season by a combined 4 points, so very close games against opponents who were Miami and Texas A&M, both of whom are in the playoff, and so clearly those two were good teams. After that, the Fighting Irish didn't lose again, but the knock against them is that the remaining 10 games on their schedule were pretty easy.
Mm-hmm.
And so after they were left out, they have actually since announced that they're just not going to bother with a postseason bowl game at all. That's a bit of a surprise. And so their athletic director, Pete Bevacqua, has been on a media tear these past 24 hours since the announcement. And here he is this morning on the Dan Patrick Show.
We take this seriously, as do other universities. And, you know, the rankings can't just be musical chairs at some, you know, fifth grade birthday party. They have to mean something. And to me, what happened to us really kind of was alarming.
Yeah. And also, BYU was left out. That's an 11-2 team whose two losses both came to the same team, number 4, Texas Tech. They got smoked in the Big 12 championships on Saturday, and so they were dropped out. But meanwhile, 10-3 Alabama also got smoked in their conference championship game on Saturday, but they got in. I can't help you understand this, Scott.
I mean, I do have to point out there's like an entire media industry devoted to hours of space for people to complain and argue about
yes.
sports. Like, I do have to wonder, no matter what, would people be complaining or arguing?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for sure. And I think the selection committee, whether it is for the college football playoff, whether it's for the NCAA March Madness basketball tournament, that's a thankless job. There's mm-hmm. always debates over who got in and who got out. I think what doesn't help is sort of a lack of consistency in their explanations, like we had with Alabama and BYU. The selection committee also told ESPN they had gone back to just scrutinize game film of Miami versus Notre Dame in week one to break a tie between those two teams. I just don't, that doesn't really scream strong argument to me
yeah.
to like go scrutinize game one or week one game film to try to figure out which team is more deserving of a playoff bid that theoretically a full season of games is the criteria for. There are two mid-majors who got in this year. That's a first for the college football playoff. So shout out to Tulane and James Madison. I hope they make a splash, but they may end up just being overmatched in their games against Ole Miss and Oregon, respectively. So there's some complaining about that, too. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of a tough one all around.
Real quick, did anybody else decide to just skip a bowl game?
Yeah, a handful of other teams, actually, including 8-4 Iowa State, whose coach just got scooped up by Penn State, and so he was going to leave and leave the team kind of rudderless. Several others also have announced that they are declining them. So that used to be a huge part of this sport. Kind of a surprise that it seems to be taking a backseat these days.
Interesting. NPR's Becky Sullivan, thank you.
You're welcome.
When the Trump administration released its national security strategy last week, officials from the European Union did not react immediately, saying that they needed time to study it. Well, what a difference a weekend can make. The reaction is now far from muted, as Terry Schultz reports from Brussels.
The chapter on Europe in the U.S. national security strategy has left many Europeans feeling somewhere between insecure and angry. Three pages full of vitriol is how French political analyst Sylvie Matelli describes the section.
Ne nous surprend pas, bien évidemment, mais qui nous interpelle.
Going on to say that while Europeans may not be surprised at the Trump administration's positions, the security strategy, or NSS, does raise questions. Among the biggest is whether the U.S. any longer sees Russia as an adversary, since the NSS says only that many Europeans regard Russia as an existential threat. Ian Lesser, head of the German Marshall Fund's office in Brussels, says that's a significant shift.
It underscores a basic difference in the current U.S. and European approaches to the war in Ukraine and to Russia, whereas, you know, the administration now, I think, sees this as simply an unpleasant problem to be fixed and put aside, taken off the table to move on to other issues.
That reading of Russia likely spells more trouble for the transatlantic relationship, says Giuseppe Spadafora of the EU Institute for Security Studies.
This is a threat that, according to the NSS, the Europeans created themselves, partly out of paranoia, and therefore it is more difficult to see a way for the European allies to remain useful to the United States, which makes it easier for the US to criticize and go against them.
And that the NSS does, saying Europe faces civilizational erasure, which it blames in large part on the European Union, due to migration policies, suppression of free speech and political opposition, and the loss of national identities. The document speculates the continent might not even be recognizable in 20 years. One bright spot for the U.S., the NSS notes, is the, quote, growing influence of patriotic European parties, which the EU considers support for the far right. This part has been perhaps the most provocative among EU officials, with European Council President Antonio Costa coming out swinging. Costa says he understands that Americans don't share European views on some things, but when it comes to the U.S. prioritizing, as the document states, cultivating resistance to Europe's current trajectory, Costa draws the line.
What we cannot accept is this threat of interference in the political life of Europe. The United States cannot replace European citizens in choosing which are the right parties and which are the wrong parties.
Costa says since the U.S. says in the NSS that Europe is still an ally, it deserves better treatment. However, a U.S. official whose job is to meet with European allies every day says it's up to Europe to change its own image. Here's Matt Whitaker, the U.S. ambassador to NATO, speaking at a conference in Doha over the weekend.
Is Europe a dynamic economy that can grow, or is it just a museum that is a relic of the past and we just go to see the cathedrals and the you know, lovely wines and cheeses and beers and waffles in the case of Brussels?
Giuseppe Spadafora says some Europeans may be counting on the fact that Trump is unpredictable and that they've managed to improve his opinion of them before.
And therefore, this could amount to nothing in practical terms.
But it will nonetheless make it harder in the future should the U.S. and Europe wish to portray a united front, for example, at NATO, especially with the Kremlin praising the NSS as something that, quote, corresponds in many ways to its own vision. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. One of the crowning achievements in global health is at risk of coming undone. Between 2000 and 2020, the number of children who died before their fifth birthday was cut in half. But new research suggests that 2025 will be the first time this century that child deaths have gone up instead of down. NPR's Gabriella Emanuel has more.
In 2000, worldwide, nearly 10 million kids died before they hit 5 years old. Today, that number is down to below 5 million, thanks to a slew of global health initiatives like widespread childhood vaccinations. Brooke Nichols is a professor of global health at Boston University.
The drop in child mortality has been a massive success, and to watch this unravel is horrifying.
New data from the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation estimate that in 2025, the number of young kids dying has gone up by 200,000 kids. Steve Lim is one of the researchers.
Now, we don't yet have direct observations on child mortality. Unfortunately, that will take a few years.
That's especially true in low-income countries without good reporting systems. Instead, Lim's team built a mathematical model that predicts child mortality based on how things like health spending in a particular country have historically been linked to child health outcomes. Lim zeroed in on one factor, the impact of cuts to foreign aid. Places like Germany, France, the UK, and the US have slashed aid contributions. Last year, all told, the world put $48 billion toward global health. This year, $36 billion.
So in other words, a more than one quarter reduction at the global level. So as you can imagine, such large cuts will have substantial consequences on health services.
Especially in places that rely a lot on aid. The analysis didn't look at specific causes of death, but they likely remain the same. Things like malaria and preterm birth complications. Lim found that if the amount of aid stays 20% lower for the next 20 years, 12 million additional kids will die above and beyond what was already predicted. Nichols of BU was not involved in the analysis, but she reviewed the methodology and says it's sound and relatively conservative.
Sometimes we talk about numbers. Oh, this is increase in mortality, a percent increase. What is a percent? It's a human. It's a child. It could be your child. It could be my child.
NPR reached out to the U.S. State Department for comment about the cuts and their impact, but did not receive a response. Gabriella Emanuel, NPR News.
The results were published as part of the Gates Foundation's annual report on development goals, and Gates is a financial supporter of NPR.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station, wherever you are. Get the NPR app for your mobile device. You can also lean back and enjoy npr.org, optimized for the iPad. This is NPR.
Support for KQED today comes from John Muir Health. Delivering cardiac surgery with a patient-first approach and minimally invasive techniques in the East Bay at John Muir Health. Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org.
President Trump is pursuing aggressive policies in the Western Hemisphere that include anti-immigration crackdowns, military strikes on suspected drug smugglers, and threats of regime change in Venezuela. His administration is now reaching back two centuries and calling the approach the Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. That story tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Stay informed. Get the latest early morning news while you are asleep starting at 2 on Morning Edition on KQED News.
I'm Alexis Madrigal. Next time on Forum, in California, mobile homes make up between 4 and 6% of the housing stock, and they play a critical role in creating affordable housing. New state laws and efforts by for-profit developers to buy up mobile home communities are putting this kind of housing at risk. We're going to talk to experts about the challenges that mobile homeowners face. That's at 9 a.m. right here on KQED.
I'm Nina Kim. Next time on Forum at 10 a.m., child farm workers. Children as young as 12 can work legally in California's agriculture industry, but they describe unsafe and unsanitary conditions, extreme heat, and a fear of speaking up because they cannot afford to lose their jobs. Journalist Robert J. Lopez spoke with 61 children who work in California's fields. We'll talk to Lopez about the state's lack of regulatory oversight and how it's responding to his reporting. That's Forum at 10 a.m. on KQED.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. IceBlock is a popular app that tracks sightings of immigration agents. But under pressure from the Trump administration, the app was removed from Apple's App Store. Now the app's developer is suing the Trump administration. NPR's Bobby Allen joins us now to talk about that lawsuit and why Trump officials say the app is such a threat. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, Elsa.
Hey, okay, so how does this IceBlock app work exactly?
Yeah, so it's a crowdsourced map app. You can download it and then anonymously send out alerts when you see an immigration and customs enforcement agent. It served as sort of an early warning system to give potential targets of immigration arrests a heads up, basically. And because it was launched during the Trump administration's sweeping raids around the country, it became very popular very fast. In just a matter of months, Elsa, it was downloaded more than a million times. But then the White House found out about it, got very angry, and came after the app.
And what was the concern here for White House officials?
Yeah, Attorney General Pam Bondi and other officials said it endangered the lives of ICE agents. Bondi said it encouraged people to incite violence against them. The app became a very hot topic in the White House. I talked to the app's developer, a guy named Joshua Aaron. He's based in Austin, Texas. And he actually remembers the exact moment he realized he had really struck a nerve with the Trump administration.
I got actually it wasn't even me, it was my wife who got the phone call. I think it was just a friend of ours who said, they just talked about Joshua in the White House press briefing. And I was like, what?
And not long after this, Bondi told Fox News she called on Apple to remove the app from the App Store. Apple did just that. This is back in October, and since then, the app has not been available for download. Then came today's lawsuit.
Then came this lawsuit. Okay, so what are the plaintiffs arguing in this lawsuit?
Yeah, the lawsuit says Bondi's pressure on Apple to boot IceBlock from its app store was illegal. Aaron's lawyer says it was a case of jawboning, and that's the legal phrase for when government officials use their power to suppress the speech of someone. Aaron right. made this app because he's against the Trump administration's crackdown. His lawyer, Noam Beal, told me that courts have found that the government trying to shut down even an app is considered illegal censorship.
You don't have to agree with Joshua's position on immigration policy to recognize that ability for people to be able to speak to each other and communicate with each other through this tool that he created is First Amendment protected activity.
And also, I should note here that I did reach out to the Department of Justice and Apple, but neither got back to me.
Okay, so if this lawsuit is successful, will the app be available again, you think?
Well, that's what the suit is trying to force, but the Trump administration is going to be fighting this quite hard. They view this app as potentially disrupting immigration raids and, as I mentioned, putting federal agents at risk. Another thing this whole saga shows is Apple bowing to political pressure, right? Mm-hmm. Apple does remove apps in other countries that make demands, but this suit points out this is the first time in Apple's history that it has done so in the U.S. So, that's all to say that free speech advocates will definitely be watching this case pretty closely.
That is NPR's Bobby Allen. Thank you, Bobby.
Thanks, Elsa.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Capital One with the Capital One Quicksilver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
A lock of hair can be a lasting remembrance of a person who died. In Independence, Missouri, hair became much more than that. For nearly 40 years, Leila's Hair Museum featured wreaths, jewelry, and other artifacts made with human hair. The museum closed earlier this year. Now the family is finding new homes for the hairy artistry. Reporter Julie Dinesha of member station KCUR reports.
From a small storefront on a busy street in Independence, Missouri, Lindsay Evans is on a mission.
Hey, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. Come on in.
Since February, she's been in contact with museums across the country to find new homes for her grandmother's most treasured artifacts.
My grandmother always said there were one of two reactions when people came in the museum. And the first one was, oh my gosh, this is hair? Wow. The other was, this is hair? Oh my gosh. And they would kind of run the other way.
The 3,000-piece collection includes Victorian-era jewelry and around 1,000 delicately crafted wreaths, all made from human hair.
Some people have a little bit of an ick factor with it. It is an odd collection.
Evan says her grandmother, Leila Cahoon, who founded the museum in 1986, died last fall, and the museum closed in September. So for almost four decades, Leila's Hair Museum was what Cahoon called the world's largest collection of hair work.
They're absolutely gorgeous. From far away, you look at them and you just think, wow, that's a beautiful piece of art. And then you get close and realize that's hair. It's absolutely incredible.
Elaborate Victorian-era wreaths encased in shadow box frames once covered the walls. Creating them took months or even years to complete. Each tells a story, like the one of sisters in Sedalia, Missouri, who created a wreath when they entered a convent. A teacher in Maine crafted another from her students' hair. One wall was devoted to hair from icons like Elvis Presley, John F. Kennedy, Marilyn Monroe, and Michael Jackson.
Packed safely away, ready to go.
Yes.
I love it. Okay.
Sarah Bader King stopped by to choose a few wreaths with local connections. She's curator at two of Kansas City's most historic structures, the John Warnell and Alexander Majors House Museums.
It just seemed like the perfect opportunity to, you know, help her keep things in Kansas City while also adding to our collection in a really substantial way.
I have my work.
As word got out that the museum was closing, a flurry of visitors have come for tours. Karen Bachman is a professor of the history of jewelry at New York's Pratt Institute.
These things got shoved in attics and forgotten about. People would look and go, I don't even know whose hair that is. But when you appreciate it and you see it in a collection such as this, they're still remembered. They're still valued.
Listening to you talk, I feel like my grandmother's here again, because the things that you're saying are the things that she would tell people about these pieces. And so I love having people here who know and appreciate this art form as much as she did.
As Evans begins to wrap up the months-long process, she says she's grateful to share her grandmother's passion.
That's what she wanted for me, and it's helping me grieve in a way I didn't even realize I needed. And so I've loved that.
Evans said her grandmother wrote in a letter that she wanted her to share Leila's Hair Museum. Now she's hoping others around the country can learn more and appreciate the unusual artifacts that will now be located elsewhere. For NPR News, I'm Julie Dinesha in Kansas City.
A partnership between a city, the school district, and a local chapter of Habitat for Humanity is building affordable homes in a pricey real estate market. We'll have the story from Boulder, Colorado on tomorrow's show. If you are not by the radio, try asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your local station by name. And you are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And support for NPR comes from Subaru. The Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor, can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. At progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. and by the listeners and sustaining members of KQED. Ahead of the world at 2, Julie, with afternoon traffic beginning around Highway 24.
And they're doing some drainage cleaning out there in Lafayette on eastbound 24 between Ocalanes and Oak Hill Road. The left lane shut down for a few more minutes, so that's why the backup to St. Stephen's Drive. Bender Oakland on North 880 before 5th Street. Couple vehicles made it to the center divide. Want to be careful heading over the Altamont east 580 before North Lynn Road. Someone dropped a pile of pallets in the right lane. Julie Deppish for KQED.
And your afternoon traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa, Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, where a commitment to pure ingredients and sustainable brewing meet a legacy of craft since 1980. Sierra Nevada, taste what matters. Please drink responsibly. You're listening to KQED 88.5 San Francisco, KQEI 89.3 North Highland.